But soon after sending it in for a new one, I got a letter back saying, "Mr. Warren, your passport was altered or mutilated and you need to reapply for another one." So, I said, "Oh fine," and filled it out. Next response, "Mr. Warren, you must re-establish US citizenship." I'm like, "What? I'm calling all these people." Finally, in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, at the National Passport Center, this woman said, "I can't tell you what's happening here." After a while, I said, "Listen, I'm writing a book called Left at Eastgate," and she goes, "The Bentwaters thing," she said, "call me at this number." It was her home number in Lebanon, New Hampshire. I called her, and she said to me, "I have the official printout. This individual's passport has been revoked under some classification, due to his speaking of sensitive defense issues at a public forum on foreign soil, and then some coding, DOD coding, under it. I have it all, and it is just bizarre." Our agent at that time, Perry Knowlton in New York City, was friends with Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General. He set up a meeting with us, and I met with Mr. Clark in person. He said to me, "I'm going to make some phone calls for you, but," he says, "I'm going to tell you this. After knowing everything, they say it was because you talked about nuclear weapons, that's all." Mr. Clark said, "People in England suspected there were nukes there all the time. I will tell you this, your passport was suspended because of the other things you've talked about," and he wouldn't elaborate anymore. He made two phone calls, and the Department of State, with apologies, said it was an error. So, we've tried to do our best. I'd be willing to speak and swear to this in front of any congressional body. I have great respect for my country, and I think it is the people's right to know. Testimonial. Lord Hill Norton is a 5-star admiral and the former head of the British Ministry of Defence. I know a good bit about the Bentwaters incident. I've interviewed a number of the people who took part in it, and what I have decided after careful thought, is that there are only two explanations for what happened that night in Suffolk. The first is that the people concerned, including Colonel Holt, who was, at the time, the deputy commander of the base, and a lot of his soldiers, claim that something from outside the Earth's atmosphere landed at their Air Force base. They went and stood by it. They inspected it. They photographed it. The following day they took tests on the ground where it had been and found radioactive traces. They reported this. Colonel Holt wrote a memorandum, which was sent to our Ministry of Defense. He has appeared on British television at least once, to my knowledge, possibly more often, in which he has repeated, effectively, what he said in that memorandum. What he said is what I have just described. That is one explanation, that it actually happened as Colonel Holt reported. The other explanation is that it didn't happen. In that case, one is bound to assume that Colonel Holt and all of his men were hallucinating. My position is perfectly clear. Either of those explanations is of the utmost defense interest. It has been reported and claimed, and I, myself, have raised it to ministers at the defense ministry in this country, that nothing they have been informed about regarding UFOs is of defense interest. Surely, to any sensible person, either of those explanations cannot fail to be of defense interest. That the colonel of an American Air Force base in Suffolk and his military men are hallucinating when there are nuclear-armed aircraft on the base, this must be of defense interest. And, if indeed what he says took place, did take place, and why on earth should he make it up, then, surely, the entry of a vehicle from outer space, and certainly not man-made, to a defense base in this country also cannot fail to be of defense interest. It simply isn't any good for our ministers, and the Ministry of Defense in particular, to say that nothing took place that December night in Suffolk, or that it is not of defense interest. It simply isn't true. Since my name has become connected with UFO matters in quite a big way in this country, and in one or two other countries too, I have frequently been asked why a person of my background, a former chief of the defense staff, a former chairman of the NATO Military Committee, why I think there is a cover-up, or what the reasons may be for governments wishing to cover up the facts about UFOs. A number of explanations have often been put forward. The most frequent, and perhaps the most plausible, is the government's concern, which is primarily that of the United States, and that of my own country, over the public's reaction if they were told the truth, which is that there are objects in our atmosphere which are technically miles in advance of anything that we can deploy, that we have no means of stopping them coming here, and that we have no defense against them, should they be hostile. I believe governments fear that if they did disclose those facts, people would panic, people would rush about and jam switchboards like they did that famous day in New Jersey, when there was a spoof that the Martians had landed. People will go mad, and they will jump up and down. I don't believe that at all. I've said so in print. I do not believe that people today, in the 21st century, are going to panic at that sort of information. After all, they have put up with the introduction of nuclear weapons and the destruction of two Japanese cities 50 years ago. They take as a matter of course that we can land vehicles on Mars. Land to the precise instant, forecast years before. So why should they panic? They are much more interested in doing the pools or the lottery. They would shrug their shoulders and take it as a matter of course. Anyway, they don't trust politicians, in my experience. What I'd like to say is that there is a serious possibility that we are being visited. And have been visited for many years. By people from outer space, from other civilizations, that it behooves us to find out who they are, where they come from, and what they want. This should be the subject of rigorous scientific investigation, and not the subject of rubbishing by tabloid newspapers. It seems to me that the Bentwaters incident is a classic case where an apparent intrusion into our rare space and indeed, a landing in our country occurred, which was witnessed by serious-minded people in the military. Responsible people, doing a responsible job. And, Bentwaters is, in a sense, a benchmark for how not to deal with these matters in the future, parenthesis. Our deepest gratitude goes to James Fox for sharing this interview. Testimonial. Daniel Sheehan, attorney. As an associate under Floyd Abrams in the First Amendment Division, he represented NBC News and the New York Times. He was also one of the defense attorneys for the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case, one of the trial lawyers in F. Lee Bailey's office representing James McCord in the Watergate burglary defense, and was chief counsel in the Karen Silkwood case. I served as chief counsel for the United States Jesuit headquarters in Washington, D.C. in their National Social Ministry office, which is their public policy office dealing with major policy issues. I served there from 1975 to 1985 under Superior General Pedro Arup, the father general from Rome. And it was during that period of time that these particular events occurred. In January of 1977, I received a telephone call from Marcia Smith, the director of the Science and Technology Division of the Congressional Research Service of the United States Congressional Library. She had been contacted by the Science and Technology Committee of the House of Representatives and had been informed that President Jimmy Carter had contacted the congressional staff in order to conduct a major investigation undertaken by the United States Congress. It seems, after being sworn in, the new president had asked the still-in-place Director of Central Intelligence, George Bush Sr., for access to the classified documents relating to unidentified flying objects and the potential existence of extraterrestrial intelligence. George Bush Sr. refused to release the information, stating, "If you want to have this information, I'm not going to give it to you on my watch. If you want to proceed before having your own DCI put in place, you would have to follow the following procedure. You'd have to go to the United States Congress, to the Science and Technology Committee of the House of Representatives, and ask them to undertake a process by means of which the Congress can get certain documents declassified. They can ask for a declassification process to be undertaken." Rather than butt heads with the Republican DCI, the president had decided to go through that process. Carter wanted answers to two questions. First, what information do we have in the government, in unclassified and classified areas, that speaks to the question of whether or not extraterrestrial intelligence exists. Second, what percentage of these UFO sightings and reports that have been coming to the government have been investigated, and is there any evidence indicating they might represent vehicles from an extraterrestrial civilization that are visiting our planet? These questions were put to the U.S. House of Representatives in January. They passed these over to the Congressional Research Service of the Library of Congress soon thereafter. It was around April when I got this telephone call. I went back to Jesuit headquarters and talked to Friar William J. Davis, who was the director of the National Social Ministry Office in the Oregon Province of Jesuits, and asked him whether or not he would consent to CO signing a letter from the national headquarters in the United States asking for this documentation from the Vatican Library. As it turns out, a Jesuit was in charge of the Vatican Library. So Friar Davis found out what his name was, and got his address and details. We sent a formal letter to this man and asked him if we, at Jesuit headquarters, could get access to that section of the Vatican Library where the information about UFOs and extraterrestrial intelligence was. Much to our surprise, about 2 weeks later, we got a letter back saying no, that we couldn't have access to this. We were shocked. This was the United States headquarters for the Jesuit order. We've got 10 provinces of Jesuits here in the United States. It's more than any other area in the entire world, making it a pretty influential place. The U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops was a major power in the Catholic world. So we were taken aback that this had happened. We prepared a second letter in much more detail, assuring them that I would personally come to Rome and do the inspection of the documents, agreeing to abide by whatever conditions were set. 2 weeks later we received a reply. Again, no. We cannot have access to this section of the Vatican Library. About 6 weeks later Marsham informed me that the SETI project, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California had just had its budget for the following year cut in half. And the people from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory asked if I would accompany them to the corresponding budget meetings. Long story short, the budget was reinstated and the top 50 scientists at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, as a thank you for any help I may have rendered, invited me to come to the JPL and to deliver a closed-door seminar on the theological implications of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. I received permission to do this. The Jesuits were suddenly more interested in the subject. They were quite put off too by not being allowed to see this stuff at the Vatican Library and began to suspect there was something there. So I called Marsha Smith and said, look, if I'm going to get to go out and meet with the top 50 scientists of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory on the SETI project, I would like to, if I could, get access to the material that you're developing here for the president. That way, at least I'm informed. She proposed making me a special assistant researcher for the Congressional Research Service on this particular project, and asked me what I wanted to see in order to prepare for this seminar. I told her I wanted to see the classified portions of Project Blue Book. A week or so later she informed me that they had agreed and would be having them sent to the Library of Congress the following Saturday, and that I would be given a brief amount of time to go in and review these. I had to go to the Madison Building on the other side of Independence Avenue from the Library of Congress. It had just opened, brand spanking new. There wasn't a single office set up in it. In fact, there was nobody in it, no staff on a Saturday morning in mid-May. I found a guard at the main entrance and told him who I was. He made a call and confirmed I was supposed to be there. He escorted me downstairs into the basement, telling me I was supposed to be in such and such room. He left me walking down the hall. At the end of the hall I turn left where I see two plainclothes guys with earplugs, sleeve mix. The whole nine yards. They're clearly expecting me because they must have been the ones that got the call from the guard. I show my identification to a guy seated at a desk. He tells me, you're not going to be allowed to take your briefcase in there, you're not going to be allowed to take any notes, and you're only going to get about an hour in there. I was wondering where all these restrictions came from, but I wasn't going to complain. I mean, I'm getting this gratis. So I put my briefcase down and kept the yellow legal pad with me. I had it just under my arm as I walked into the other room. There was a table inside. Stacked on top were 16 to 20 beige green rectangular boxes, maybe 2 feet long and a half foot wide, and about another half foot deep. They had these little string tabs on the side for connecting them. I didn't know where to start. I thought, if I'm only going to get an hour or so like this, if I start reading documents I'm not going to get much done. Instead, I decided to look for photographs. There were actually a couple of other boxes that had film in them and a tiny projector, so I began there. I threaded some film through the projector and clicked it on, and I started seeing UFO stuff. Only stuff I'd seen elsewhere. Realizing this wasn't classified, I went looking through the other boxes. One contained a paper wrapping that said top secret. Beneath it was a canister of microfiche and a machine with a little hand crank. I threaded through the first microfiche, only it's more documents. The next, more documents, and more. Finally I hit upon a microfiche of photographs, and there they were. I mean, there wasn't any doubt about what this was. This was a crashed UFO. It was a winter scene, there was snow on the ground. There was a recovery team present. Two men were measuring the craft with a tape measure. From these black and white photographs you could see this big trench mark, like the ship had come through this field and the UFO had struck the side of this embankment. It had kind of nosed into it, so you couldn't quite see the bottom part. There was a dome on top. And there were little engraving marks on the side of it. There was a close-up photograph of the section of the craft that had these symbols. I looked at it, then I turned around at the door of the room I was in to check on the guards. They weren't looking. Quickly, I opened the yellow legal pad to its cardboard backing. Focusing the microfiche projection of the symbols onto the cardboard, I traced the entire long string of symbols that were the using my pen. And I was absolutely fastidious about it to make sure they were exact. When I finished, I cranked the microfiche out of the projector and put everything away in the exact same spot where I had found it. Then I announced I was done. The guy at the desk looked at me and said, "Mr. Sheehan, what have you got there?" I handed the pad to him and he flipped through the yellow pages, never looking at the cardboard backing. He handed it back to me. I stuck it under my arm, picked up my briefcase and I just walked right out. I went back to Jesuit headquarters, straight to Friar Davis's office and showed it to him. I never called Marcia Smith about it. I didn't tell people at SETI about it either. Marcia shared with me the findings from the Congressional Research Service report on the probability of extraterrestrial existence and the analysis of the UFO phenomenon. It opened right up with saying the Congressional Research Service, having reviewed unclassified and classified data, has come to the conclusion that there are at least 2 to 6 other highly, technologically developed intelligent civilizations inside our galaxy. Just a simply stated fact, just like that. And this was the information provided to the president. With regard to the UFOs, they pointed out that there were 7 or 8 different shapes of craft that were classically reported, with 20% credible, reliable accounts of vehicles that they concluded were not ours, and did not belong to the Soviet Union, and appeared to have technological capabilities that made it absolutely clear that they were of no known origin on this planet. Only they wouldn't go on to the next step, ergo, they must be from some other planet. They didn't say that in the report. It was really interesting how they did that. I've thought about this. As a constitutional scholar and a practicing constitutional lawyer now for 30 years, and having worked on some fairly interesting cases, from the Pentagon Papers case, to the Iran-Contra case as chief counsel on the civil case against the off-the-shelf enterprise of Richard Secord and Albert Hakim, the people who were working with Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. And I am completely confident that this secrecy is a violation of the Neutrality Act. The Neutrality Act is a federal statute under Title 18 of the United States Code that prohibits private citizens from engaging in any type of warlike activities against any other non-United States entity without authorization from Congress. And it's perfectly clear to me, based upon the analysis I've done of previously classified documents, that the Intelligence Committees, the Select Committee on Intelligence of the House and Senate, do not know about this. That there have been presidents of the United States that don't know about this. I talked with Lawrence Rockefeller once about this. Lawrence Rockefeller had a direct meeting with President Clinton and asked him about this. And he told me that Clinton didn't know about this either. Based upon that, I'm very confident in saying that this is an unconstitutional activity that's going on here. That the chain of command, the military chain of command, has been broken on this. The constitutional chain of command has been broken on this. The agreements to set up the intelligence committees now that followed after the Watergate burglary and the Nixon impeachment hearings. It's perfectly clear that they've broken the chain of command on this. The difficulty here is that it's a federal criminal statute, therefore, the Justice Department would have to be brought in. But there is a way of getting at this. Under the Federal Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act, the RICO statute, one of the predicate acts, or one of the criminal actions that would trigger civil jurisdiction, is a violation of the Neutrality Act. And I believe, based upon the evidence that I've seen, previously classified evidence, of having talked with people who are now talking about this, that, in fact, there are probably 8 or 10 major federal statutes that have been violated, at least a half dozen of which are predicate acts of the Federal Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organization Act. I believe that there is probable cause to justify a civil action. Questions of standing are important. Who among the citizenry would have standing to bring such an action? I believe it is extremely important that, as citizens of the United States, we fund a professional private investigation. I am completely convinced that we could, in fact, discover what's been going on here and what type of criminal statutes have been violated. Testimonial. Lance Corporal, Marine, John Weygand was stationed in Peru to provide perimeter security to a drug traffic radar installation. I enlisted in the Marine Corps under the delayed entry program. I went to boot camp, graduated, and was given a new military occupational skill listing as a 7212 Stinger Avenger and trained to be an air defense gunner on the FIM-92 Alpha Stinger missile, the surface-to-air missile, and the Avenger weapon. After graduating, I was reassigned to a 1st Duty Station, 2nd Marine Air Wing, 28th Marine Air Control Group, 2nd Air Defense Battalion Troop in North Carolina. 9 months later, we shipped out to Peru. We were sent there to provide perimeter security to this radar installation that was tracking supposed drug aircraft that were exiting in and out of Peruvian and Bolivian airspace. One night, Sergeant Allen and Sergeant Atkinson came to us and said, "Look, we have got a situation where we have an aircraft crash and it is possibly friendly and they need us to go and secure crash site." About 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, we headed out in 6 Hummers. We drove as far as we could, then humped it through the bush. We arrived at the site about 6:30 a.m. as it started to get light. There was a huge gash in the land where something big had crashed. Everything was burned like something had been on fire, or maybe it was some kind of energy like laser. It was really strange. I was in the front with Sergeant Allen and Sergeant Atkinson. We were 10 to 20 meters ahead of everyone else. All of us had maps and radios and compasses so we wouldn't get lost. We didn't go straight up, we went to the left and walked to the top of the ridge, and that is when we saw the craft. It had gone up the hill and then off in the side of the ravine and ridge. This is about a 200-foot ridge, solid rock. The ship was huge, it was buried in the side of a cliff at a 45-degree angle, straight up and down. It was dripping a greenish-purple syrup-like liquid and it was everywhere. It kind of fluctuated. You would look at it one time and then you would look at it again, and it was almost like it was alive and changing, but every time that you looked at it you saw a different shade of greenish purple. There was one light on the ship that slowly went around. And the machine, I could hear it because it was still functioning and it had a hum to it. It was like a bass that you unplugged from a guitar amp, that kind of deep sound, and it kind of fluctuated and then finally it cut off and everything just seemed to stop. Looking at the craft, it was buried nose first, so I could see the back of it. There were these large things that looked like vents, sort of like fish gills on the back. I couldn't see around the other side, but I assume it was the same way. The liquid that had come out of the ship got on my camis, and it discolored them and ate through them, almost like acid. It ate some of the hair off my arms. I didn't know that until later on. I was down there with the ship. There were three holes in it. I assumed that they were hatches, but there was no way to tell. They were not flush with the main body of the craft. They were, I don't know, a few inches below. I knew that there was one on top because you could slightly see it. I don't know about the other side. There was another hatch the same width and diameter of the top hatch, and it was kind of to the side and it was half open. I didn't see any lights or anything coming out of it, but I felt this presence. It was real strange. I think the creatures calmed me. It was weird, but I think they were trying to communicate with me telepathically. It was really weird, like sitting in your car and turning on an AM radio station that is just noise and turning it up real high. That is what I heard when I first got in there. The ship was about 10 meters in width and about 20 meters in length. It was shaped like something between an egg and a teardrop. It looked really aerodynamic. I was close enough to see it was not just smooth. There were bumps and notches and things on it. It was really organic, almost like art. It looked like it could have been handmade, but out of what materials, I don't know. It looked metal, but it didn't have any reflection on it. The sun was shining on it and I could see the different shades of the craft, and it didn't reflect anything. I guarantee that if I had shone a flashlight on it, it wouldn't have reflected it. There was no debris that I saw, but there were big gashes in the rear of the aircraft like it had been hit with a surface-to-air missile. We had a couple of Hawk batteries, they're homing all the way killers. A low to medium anti-aircraft missile. Basically, the missile doesn't have to hit the target in order to destroy it. What it does is it gets in proximity of it and it has a high explosive fragmentation warhead, and it basically explodes like a big shotgun in the vicinity of the targeted area. And by fragmentation, it is supposed to destroy the target, or damage it so it won't be able to continue its mission. So I think that we shot it down. I wanted to get inside because someone, the creatures I think, were calling me to help them. Suddenly Sergeant Allen and Sergeant Atkinson were hollering and cussing at me to get the hell out of there. I think that they were scared and they didn't want me to get hurt. After we climbed back up, the Department of Energy people were there and I was arrested. I had all my gear taken from me by men in black camis. They had no name tags. They were older men, probably in their late 30s or 40s, and they wore containment suits. They took me and cuffed me on a cot that they had. They had my legs tied together with those plastic fasteners that the police use. They placed me in this huge 47 (Chinook) helicopter, and we took off. They were cussing at me, saying that I was a dumb asshole. Why don't you fucking people ever pay attention to orders? You weren't supposed to be there. You are not supposed to see this. You are going to be dangerous if we let you go. I thought that they were going to kill me. I sat in there for, I don't know, 15 hours. They put this light in my face and they were yelling at me. I couldn't readily identify any of these guys, but I knew one of them was at the crash site because I recognized him and he was in black fatigues. He was saying, "What did you see? Are you a patriot? Do you like the Constitution?" I'm like, "Yeah." He said, "We are on our own program. We don't obey. We just do what we want." And they are growling and they are relishing it. They are yelling at me and hollering and cursing. "You didn't see anything. We will do you and your whole goddamn family. We are going to take you off in a helicopter and we are going to kick your ass out in the jungle and we are going to end you. They didn't physically put their hands on me, but I was handcuffed to the chair and I couldn't move, so basically it was just harassment. I didn't eat anything for a whole day. No water. No nothing. I just sat there. They held me for 2 days.